Welcome to Power Play as pipeline decision aftershocks reverberated across the political landscape. We have Alberta's happy premier and a very unhappy pipeline opponent just ahead. Also coming up on today's show, the Auditor General has a blunt assessment of government's failing to serve Canadians. But his decision was kind of bumped out of yesterday's All Pipeline show. So we will have Michael Ferguson today to discuss what he sees as deja vu government. Speaking of foot dragging, Canada's top Aboriginal leader is speaking out about the government's failure to act on the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's recommendations. He'll be here to discuss that and pipeline politics. And the long-awaited blueprint for changing the way Canadians vote comes out tomorrow. We will ask the MPs if it's dead on arrival. But first, the day after the hardest decisions of his mandate so far, Justin Trudeau faced a torrent of pro and con pipeline reaction. There were demonstrations in Vancouver last night as Alberta was the big winner from yesterday's approval, both for the Trans Mountain Pipeline through southern BC to Vancouver and the Line 3 pipeline to Wisconsin from Edmonton. That opens up two expanded export outlets for the province's oil sands. Alberta Premier Rachel Notley, very happy as she is, joins us from inside the Ottawa Bureau. Premier Notley, take me back to when you heard from the Prime Minister that these two pipelines were going to go through. What was your reaction?
Well, of course, we were very excited when we got news of it. It was a very good day for Alberta. As you know, we've been through some tough economic times since the collapse in oil prices in Alberta. And this particular announcement shows us a bit of a light at the end of the tunnel. And it's good news for families, not only in Alberta, but across the country, who are focused on ensuring healthy job prospects and prosperity for all Canadians.
So now Alberta's got a connection to the Pacific Ocean. What does that mean for Alberta's oil sands?
Oh, well, it's really good news. What it means is that we can get access now to China and other Asia-Pacific markets. It means that we can get a much better price for our product. It means that we can be more economically independent of our neighbors to the south. I mean, there's nothing, and we, of course, they are our biggest trading partners, and they always will be. But we need to have the ability to pick our markets as it works best for us. And this is something that has been long overdue.
Well, what's your reaction to Ron Ambrose, the Conservative interim leader, who says that this pipeline will never get built unless Justin Trudeau puts his personal heft behind it? Do you think that's going to require his personal cheerleading?
I think it's going to still require a lot of cheerleading on a lot of people's parts and a lot of conversations and listening to people's concerns and then addressing those concerns. We've already seen the federal government make a very hefty investment in terms of coastal water safety. And of course, the government of Alberta has put a cap on emissions so that this pipeline should and can be delinked from the issue of and the conversation around greenhouse gas emissions. And so that's what happens when you actually talk to people. And I think that's certainly what our government has been doing. And I think that's what we're seeing the federal government work on doing as well.
Okay, help me understand how you can successfully cap emissions if you'll have up to three pipelines, and that includes the Keystone XL pipeline getting approved. They'll be humming along at capacity 10 years down the road. It seems hard to believe you'll be able to cap emissions when you've got so much more production going into the pipe.
Well, in fact, what's happening right now is that in the Alberta legislature, the legislated cap is being debated in the House. So it's a piece of legislation that we're putting in place. It's a cap that industry has itself agreed to. And we're going through a process of divvying up the space that remains under that cap. And so what that means then is that industry has to make a major investment into technology and innovation to reduce the emissions that are produced through their production efforts. And that's what they've committed to doing, and that's the way we keep we respect the cap, and we don't allow it to go to the huge levels that would have happened otherwise.
What's your message to First Nations and environmental groups and people like Elizabeth May, who say they'll lie down in front of the bulldozers to prevent this pipeline going through?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think, I respect that people have very strong views on this, and that's good. And certainly in Canada, we have to be able to debate. But at the end of the day, families should not be forced to choose between the security of their job, their ability to put food on the table, to take care of their kids, and the future of the environment. And what we have done in Alberta is we have worked very hard. We have engaged in unprecedented efforts to put in place a climate leadership plan in Alberta, which quite frankly is leading the country. We're phasing out of coal. We've got the emissions cap in place. We're making a massive investment in renewable energy and energy efficiency. These are things that are going to help the environment. And so at the same time, we need to be able to ensure that we don't create a bunch of Flint, Michigans across Canada. What we have to do is keep our eye on the needs of people to have jobs and to remain prosperous. And this pipeline is a critical piece in that puzzle.
Of course, I always think people forget it's something like 70 cents out of every dollar in the energy sector that benefits the rest of Canada.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. And you know, over 250,000 people are employed in the oil and gas sector. And in Alberta alone, just in 1 year, you know, there were 65,000 jobs lost. These are people's lives. And we are all part of this country. And I think that we're working very hard to do our share on the environmental piece, and we'll continue to do that. But we all need to work together, because as I say, it's not a choice between the two. The two can move forward together effectively. That's what we're doing, and I hope people will see that.
All right, so bottom line, is approval for two out of these three pipelines enough? Will that be enough to handle the production that you need to get to these new markets?
Well, you know, I think we're still looking at the issue. I know New Brunswick would like the opportunity to be able to invest in upgrading oil from Alberta. We'd like to be able to have people in Ontario buying oil from Alberta as opposed to from offshore sources. And we'd like to have even more diversity in our market opportunities. So those are conversations that I think will happen over the years to come as that process unfolds. But certainly right now, today is a very good day, and it demonstrates, I think, to many investors that we are still a place where economic prosperity is something we can count on.
All right, so is Trudeau mania coming to Alberta soon?
I'm not going to speak to that. I'm just going to say yesterday was a very good day for Alberta families.
Premier Natalie, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, take care.
Okay, British Columbia Premier Christy Clark, who's facing an election next spring, didn't react on the pipeline decisions until this afternoon. She emerged to give Trans Mountain one thumb up pending full implementation of her five demands. Here's what she had to say.
The federal government, through its work, as a result of our very hard work over the last 4.5 years, has come very, very close to making sure that they meet the five conditions that we set out over 4 years ago. When I spoke to the Prime Minister yesterday, I told him that I very much look forward to him coming to British Columbia to share the thinking, his thinking, behind the decision that he and his cabinet have made, come to British Columbia in our province, and talk to the people here about why this project, why he believes that this project is indeed in the national interest.
Well, there are plenty of signs that the pipeline will face blockades of protest as the expansion snakes its way toward the Burnaby Dock, where roughly one oil tanker a day will be given a fill-up. Demonstrations erupted in Vancouver shortly after the Trans Mountain decision was announced. Vancouver City Council Adrian Carr spoke to the protesters last night, and she joins us now from our Vancouver studio. Councillor Carr, what was it like in that last night in that crowd?
It was a great protest, and it sure speaks to the fact that British Columbians feel betrayed by Trudeau and are ready to take this issue to the line, blockade peacefully in order to stop the building of this pipeline.
Do they think it'll go beyond the legal type of protest? Could civil disobedience really become an issue?
That was certainly talked about a lot last night. Speaker after speaker said that if that's what it's going to take, if this is going to be another Clockwood Sound, it will make Clockwood Sound look like a picnic in the park. There's going to be so many protesters.
Who was in that crowd, though, Adrian? Was it a lot of First Nations there? Are these Green Party people? Like, you're a part of the Green Party as well, at least on City Council. Who are they?
There were a lot of First Nations there, leaders that were speaking. There were people that are obviously from a whole variety of environment groups. There were a lot of youth. There were seniors there. There were politicians there, members of parliament, myself. You know, it was a very broad spectrum of people who were saying, you know, I feel betrayed. This is not the right decision. This is not going to lead to any good outcomes, especially in terms of climate change.
What's the big concern there? Is it the route on land or what happens after it's loaded onto tankers?
Oh, that's a good question. Because the protest was in Vancouver, I think people are concerned about the, you know, the end result, which is that the ships in Burnaby get loaded with diluted bitumen. It's tarry, it's sticky, it's not good stuff. And more than a tanker a day, 10 a week would be in the plans, coming through our harbor only at low tide because the ships are so big and it's so shallow that there's hardly any draft. To put them through. It's a risky passage, and people are worried about a spill. 99% of oil spills in protected waters are human error. You can't avoid it, and moreover, you cannot clean up bitumen. There is no technology to do it.
So the five conditions that Christy Clark has put down, you're obviously not buying into them as enough.
Well, no, and you know, the science isn't there and the modeling wasn't there. One of the big reasons the city of Vancouver has said no to the whole Kinder Morgan pipeline and no to the National Energy Board's recommendation is because there was no modeling at all, not one study about the marine effects of an oil spill, about modeling a bitumen spill in our waters and the consequences of it. No modeling on the impact that this would have on the aquatic life, on the endangered South resident killer whale population. I mean, that's just not good enough.
I know that your mayor is very vocally against it. Is City Council united against this project?
No. I would say that we're not united on this issue, but there's a vast majority, 8 of us out of 11 who are. So the Vision councillors and myself are staunchly in opposition to it, and the 3 NPA councillors, they have not come out in opposition.
So what can you do to stop this, or are you fairly powerless to do anything?
Well, I don't think anybody's powerless to do anything. So, I mean, I was there in the Clackwood days when the Premier Harcourt at that time announced the balanced decision in Clackwood Sound, and protests ensued, actions by the First Nations, and in the end, we changed that decision. I think the same absolutely can happen. First Nations are taking a lead. Certainly the city, Burnaby, Vancouver, Victoria, all 3 mayors, all 3 councillors have said, we're going to fight this. There's an unresolved court case going on between Vancouver and the NEB decision. We are in conversation, and we will have many conversations with First Nations and other players out here on the coast in terms of our options. And people, as of last night's demonstration, made it very clear, they are starting training now for nonviolent civil disobedience. You know, I think that this is going to be a very long haul, but ultimately I'm going to trust the people and the First Nations to take the lead and to stop this from happening.
Okay. Doesn't sound like the story's over. It's just beginning. Thank you very much, Councillor Carr. Appreciate it.
Yeah. My pleasure.
All right. Coming up, the MPs talk pipelines, the latest Liberal fundraising controversy, and they'll set up tomorrow's big electoral reform announcement. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Let's bring out our MP panel, a trio of well-mannered MPs that they are. They're in the studio, but they got an awful lot of disagreement on their plates. Let's serve up their big take on the 3 issues on the parliamentary agenda today. Arif Rani is a Liberal MP from Toronto. Conservative environment critic Ed Fast is the MP for Abbotsford. And British Columbia MP Murray Rankin is the NDP House Leader, and he's from Victoria. Beautiful Victoria. Okay, welcome to the show. You guys saying Justin Trudeau broke a promise by approving Kinder Morgan. How do you figure?
Absolutely. He came to my community and he said that we would have a brand new process to review this pipeline. They didn't do that. They promised there'd be a new process for First Nations. They simply used the Harper NEB panel process, took their recommendations, and that was it. So people in my community honestly are devastated and angry.
Ed Fast, you know Vancouver politics very well. What's the big problem in Vancouver? Like, wouldn't the Harper government have done the same thing?
Well, what we have said is that any process that approves pipelines has to be one that's at arm's length from government. It has to be science and evidence-based. The National Energy Board process is exactly that. We trust that process. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, what the Prime Minister has done, on the one hand, he has said, you know what, the science and the evidence on Kinder Morgan is sound, so I'm going to approve it. But, you know, he doesn't refer to the science and evidence on the Northern Gateway project, which was also sound and was approved by the National Energy Board, and he said no for whatever reason. Clearly, it was a political decision on his part. Yeah. That's why we're highly critical of him. He should have approved that project because it would have created tens of thousands of jobs across Canada.
But you don't have a problem per se with the Trans Mountain going ahead?
No. Okay. We fundamentally support the decision of the NEB because it was based on science and on evidence.
Okay, so Murray says your boss broke a promise. Ed says your boss should have approved more pipelines. Where are you on this?
Well, squarely in the middle.
Of course.
Don, it's fascinating to hear this. We hear it in the House and we're hearing it again today. One party wants us to approve no pipelines. One party wants us to approve all pipelines.
So you found the sweet spot?
What we've done is we've actually, and it's not accurate, the characterization that Murray has portrayed in terms of the NEB process. We put in place interim principles that actually stipulated that there be greater consultation with Indigenous communities and on the environment. We had those consultations. We received the evidence. We took in that evidence, and that evidence informed the decision
on... I know what you're going to say.
On TMX and secondly on the Northern Gateway.
Does Justin Trudeau have what he calls social license to go ahead with this, which means community support?
We very much believe that we've got social license, and I'll tell you why, Don, because you cannot transition to a low-carbon economy overnight. Some parties may want us to do that. That's unrealistic. We've put in place mechanisms, the most important of which is a price on carbon pollution around the country. Even today, the Premier of Saskatchewan was indicating statements in support of what we are doing going forward. 93% of the country is under a price on carbon. We're investing in green infrastructure. We're investing in clean growth. We're working towards meeting COP21 targets. That is the social license that people believe that we have created by virtue of the important environmental standards we've put in place that allows us to take Rachel Notley's terrific price on carbon, use that as a springboard to launch a mechanism that will allow taking Alberta oil to Tidewater in a way that is environmentally responsible and yet creates economic growth.
You beg to differ?
There's no social license for this in coastal British Columbia. Already there are thousands of people on the street. Clackwood Sound's going to be a picnic compared to what this government is facing. Look, people voted for Liberal MPs because many of them said very clearly in the campaign that they were opposed to Kinder Morgan, that we would, quote, redo the process. To suggest that they've redone the process, Don, I appeared before this road show that they did with three people. It was a joke. They didn't take notes. They didn't allow any questioning. They just sat there, and you know what? They said something pretty dramatic. They said some people like this project and some don't. Well, thank you very much.
Ed, quick thought from you. Your interim leader yesterday said this isn't going to get built. Do you share that? Do you think that protest is going to stop this? And if you think protest could get in the way of it, what should the government do to let it get built? Because getting pipeline to the coast is important.
Well, I hope this pipeline does get built because it is critical to Canada's national economy, to our national prosperity. And what needs to happen is the Prime Minister needs to get behind this project solidly to make sure that it does get built. And this is not only about social license, it is about the rule of law. And I agree with Murray that the interim process that Justin Trudeau introduced was an absolute joke. It was all about emotion. Yes, it was additional consultation. There was not a shred of science or evidence that was part of that interim process. And we as Conservatives, we believe we need to respect the rule of law, an independent process, the National Energy Board process, which is an environmental approval process that takes into account science and evidence. And that process determined this pipeline, Kinder Morgan, as well as the other two, could be built and operate it in a sustainable way.
Yeah, but shouldn't you respect the results? And that is that the Liberals have managed to get two pipelines starting to move, and the Conservatives didn't, and you had 10 years.
Actually, I'll correct you on that.
Out of country once.
No, we actually approved the Northern Gateway project. You know that, Don.
Subject to...
Well, of course, they have the same challenge.
But the court threw it out, right?
Well, yes, the court threw it out, but we approved it.
And we hope they throw this one out, too, Don. I've already started...
And understand, Don, that these other two projects... are simply announcements by the federal government that they now approve of them, they still have to get built.
Yeah.
And there's some doubt as to whether they will get built.
You got a quick last word on this one?
I absolutely have a quick last word. I think the evidence is in the benefit agreements with Indigenous peoples that relate to both of these approvals. $327 million is now on the table that will strengthen those First Nations. That's the exact type of consultation that didn't happen under the previous government, that happened based on those interim principles, and that will strengthen
those First Nations communities. We've got the National Chief coming up. We'll ask him about that. I want to talk quickly about fundraising. Globe and Mail broke a story yesterday. Jamie didn't get to discuss it in yesterday's show, but that the MP in charge of marijuana legalization was discussing pot with lobbyists and cannabis lounge operators at one of those pay-for-access fundraisers. And then The Tie, another magazine, says a Toronto businessman who wants to sell $1 billion worth of canola to China, was rubbing elbows with the Prime Minister just a few months before Justin Trudeau went over to China, and lo and behold, got a deal for canola seed exports to become. I guess I need to put this in perspective. Is there a chance here, Ed, that this is just two happenstance incidents where, you know, the wrong people happen to talk shop to the wrong minister or the Prime Minister, or do you see something more nefarious here?
Well, I do see something more nefarious. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Every day
you never did this, by the way. You were a minister.
No, okay. Cash for access, never. I can tell you as a minister.
Okay. I just want to clear
we go on. I'm not aware of a situation where I spoke at a fundraiser where, in fact, someone was present that was lobbying me for any particular benefit. But I can tell you this. Day after day, there are new revelations coming forward about how the Liberals have used cash for access to ingratiate themselves with special interest groups. They've been lobbied by really high-profile players in the various industries. Today, we heard about a new brewing scandal. You know, this whole cash for access story is becoming murkier and murkier as the days go by. And I expect in the coming days, you're going to see even more of this.
Oh.
This is not going to be a pretty picture at the end.
Mary?
I'm very saddened by it. I mean, the Prime Minister put a statement out, it doesn't obviously mean anything, where he said the appearance of conflict, where you have preferential access, is something that's not allowed. Well, how can anybody think that the appearance of conflict isn't present in these circumstances?
It's just a bit of a perception problem.
It's right here in writing. If
this isn't perceived conflict, what could qualify as a perceived conflict?
The situation with these fundraisers that have been coming up, you know, people are raising valid concerns. They're concerned about is there a transactional component to what the government is doing when we're implementing policy? Perfectly valid consideration. Fundraising is a fundamental component of what all political parties do. So let's get that out on the table. And in terms of actually delivering access to individuals, we are an extremely open government that has been accused on this panel by members of both of these parties as being over-consultative in terms of showing too much access and engaging with Canadians to too great extent, to the point where it's slowing down things. So let's put that out on the table. In terms of what we're doing, when any instance has been raised, for example, with the marijuana group at the fundraiser for a riding association for a Toronto MP when Bill Blair was president, the second that was brought to our attention, in fact, we've learned that the group purchased a ticket to the fundraiser and registered as a lobbyist the same day, making it impossible for us to reconcile our records. As soon as we learned about that registration, the money was returned.
Okay.
That's what a responsible government does, and that's what we're doing.
That company, Canopy, one of those marijuana companies, the stock price dramatically went up on a certain day.
Yeah.
And that raises additional questions.
As well.
By the way, the obligation to avoid a perceived conflict of interest. In the minister's mandate letter, it says, is not simply discharged by simply acting within the law. And yet, what we hear in the House of Commons is the defense from the Prime Minister and his ministers that, well, we fully complied with the laws of Canada, so we're okay. The Prime Minister promised change. He was going to raise the ethical level, the ethical standard. And now he is violating that standard almost on a weekly basis.
And he put it in writing, as Don said. And even if it weren't in writing, the common law conflict of interest is an appearance of conflict. People get that. It doesn't pass the nod test or the smell test.
Very quick.
You forgive me if I'm a bit incredulous, Don, when the ethics czar for the previous government was actually arrested and taken away in shackles. Dean Del Mastro.
That's the point. I want to move on very quickly. Almost out of time. Electoral reform drops the big committee blueprint tomorrow that could change the way Canadians vote in the future. But it sounds like the fix might be in the sense that, if there's no consensus, The minister says there won't be any change in the way it is. Do you think the fix is in, Murray? Do you think this committee, if it doesn't recommend status quo, it'll be...
I truly want to believe that the government will play ball. All the other opposition parties have put water in their wine. We didn't want a referendum. The Conservatives did. We said, okay, let's go and we'll do that because it's the price of admission to get real change like the Prime Minister promised. I don't know what the report's going to say, Don. I just hope the Liberals understand that they've made a very solemn commitment. Last election, first pass the post. All the experts say proportional representation. Let's put it to the people of
Canada
to get
quickly,
it done.
Very quickly, I'm out of time, Ed. What do you think?
We say if you want to change the fundamental rules of democracy, you need to go to the people. Every single Canadian should have the ability to vote yay or nay on any new system that might be proposed.
We're looking forward to hearing from Canadians, but we're also looking forward to hearing that report. We're not going to speculate what's in it or our position on it until we have chance to review.
All right, that's tomorrow's story. All right, thank you all. Appreciate you coming in. Get up there and vote. All right, coming up, the Auditor General's fall report was kind of pipelined out of our show lineup yesterday, but it's far too interesting to ignore. Michael Ferguson is standing by with his key findings. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, the Auditor General's fall report yesterday served up a long lineup of improvement projects for the Trudeau government, but it was topped by his frustrated plea for real action over chronic inaction on earlier recommendations. Auditor General Michael Ferguson waited patiently in our green room yesterday while Justin Trudeau announced pipelines. We didn't get him on, but we got you on today, and we really appreciate you coming in again.
Thank you.
That was quite a... I found in your report, usually I look for the findings of the audits, but your opening statement I found most interesting. You seem very frustrated with the government's lack of action. Tell us what prompted that at this time.
Well, it just seemed like the right time to do it. I've been in this position now for 5 years. I've seen about 100 audits that we have prepared. We're just over 1 year into the mandate of the current government. So it seemed to be the right time to send a message that we just keep seeing the same problems over and over again. Sometimes the problems actually get worse. You know, I mean, if you look at the audit we did on retention and recruitment in the armed forces, the issues we raised in this audit were the same things we raised 10 years ago, same thing we raised 14 years ago, right? So the same types of issues keep coming up over and over again. And our fundamental and my fundamental frustration, I guess, is about the fact that that government departments don't seem to design their programs in a way to help the citizens, right? Everything that the government does is intended to serve citizens in one way or another, but we see so many programs that take too long to make decisions, like in the case of the Canada Revenue Agency, right? Or where there isn't accurate reporting to the public about what the government departments have actually achieved, that we just, you know, this was the right time to send a message that you know, they need to find a different way to deal with those issues and stop those issues from recurring and coming up time and time again in our audits.
So what is it, like systemic bureaucratic butt protection? Is that what's going down here?
Well, I think it's just a matter of, that departments don't put the interests of the individual Canadian who's trying to navigate the system. They don't put that first. Again, in the case of the Canada Revenue Agency with how they handle tax objections, we found that in the case of even the moderate complexity files that they tell a taxpayer to expect to wait up to a year before they'll even be contacted by an agent, and it will be a year and a half before they will get a decision. And then 65% of the time, they'll find that the taxpayer was partially or fully right. Mm-hmm. So that's just too long a time period to make somebody wait around for an answer. We've seen issues like that in the past when we looked at the CPP disability program or veterans trying to access mental health services. Mm-hmm. You know, just decisions that take too long and don't take into account the point of view of the person trying to navigate the system.
I also found you pinpointed a lot of spending's gone into border security, and yet it seems like they poured the money in and said, there, we spent the money. But they never said in advance, this is what we desire the outcome to look like.
Well, and that was, what we were concerned about was all of this money, and they spent $600 million to date, 18 departments, 34 initiatives. All of these initiatives were supposed to increase security at the border or speed up travel and trade at the border. they can tell you that they've done the initiatives, but they can't really tell you whether there has been any impact on security at the border, right? So one of the initiatives cost $80 million, what they call a single window, to allow importers to just register what they are importing once with the federal government instead of multiple times. Spend $80 million on this system, but so far, even though it's been in place more than a year, less than, significantly less than 1% of all imports are actually being recorded through that system.
Wow. I do want to bring up one that I found particularly, you know, usually auditor generals don't show emotion, but this seemed like anger coming out of the pages. Indigenous inmates, the release from prison, it sounds to me like they're just systemic racism in the sense that they're not released into parole on early release. They're kept there till the last possible date. What's going on?
Well, I mean, what we, and the way I characterized it was that we see that the indigenous offenders are caught in a vicious circle, right? Because what happens is from the moment they get in the door of a correctional institution, Correction Service Canada doesn't have all the information.